Good afternoon, and welcome to today's broadcast of the Fireside Chats, presented by the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society, and broadcast on www.sechistorical.org. I'm Teresa Gabaldon, Lyle T. Alverson Professor of Law at the George Washington University School of Law, and moderator of the Fireside Chats. The SEC Historical Society preserves and shares the history of securities regulation through its virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org. The museum is free and accessible worldwide at all times and is on track to welcome 100,000 visitors this year. The virtual museum and archive, as well as the Society, are separate from and independent of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, and receive no government funding. We thank Pfizer, Inc. for its sponsorship of the 2008 Fireside Chat season. Its support, along with gifts and grants from many other institutions and individuals, make possible the growth and outreach of the virtual museum and archive. Today's program is one in a series of Fireside Chats looking at the distinctive history and work of many of the major SEC divisions and offices. This series is a part of the Society's commemoration of the 75th anniversary of the SEC in 2009. During this year, the Fireside Chats have looked at the work of the SEC Office of the General Counsel, the Office of International Affairs, the regional offices, and the Division of Enforcement. The Society's annual meeting looked at the Division of Investment Management. All of these programs can be accessed again in the online programs section of the museum. At the end of today's chat, I'll give you a preview of the Fireside Chats scheduled for next winter and spring. Today's Fireside Chat looks at the SEC Office of Compliance Inspections and Examinations, popularly known as OC. I'm delighted to welcome John Walsh, OC's Chief Counsel. John assisted some of the museum's earliest programs on the special study of securities markets and enforcement, so it's good to have him participate in making history today as well as recording it. John's remarks today are solely his own and are not representative of the opinions of the Society. He cannot give legal or investment advice. John, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I was hoping that you might be able to start us off today with a description, in at least general terms, of what it is that OC does.
Sure. I'd be happy to do that, though, of course, before I do that, I need to give you my own standard disclaimer. Not only do I not represent the opinions of the Society, I do not necessarily represent the views of the Commission, the Commissioners, or my colleagues on the Commission staff. What does OC do? Well, it is first and fundamentally a law enforcement program. The Commission has divided law enforcement into two parts. To use some of the popular terminology of the day, I think with the Division of Enforcement, it has a program that looks to the outcomes, to the results of what people do. With OC, it looks to more preventive, to get in before people have violated the law, and hopefully to help prevent them from violating the law. To do this, we do examinations. We do examinations of broker-dealers, investment advisors, investment companies, transfer agents, self-regulatory organizations, exchanges, clearing agencies. The list goes on. More recently, the PCAOB, and very recently, rating agencies. And if I've forgotten any types of registrants, I apologize. In doing these examinations, we're a field office. We go out, we deal directly with the firms, we gather evidence, and we look for problems or potential problems. And that's our fundamental mission.
I've had several questions from students over the years about just how it is that OC differs from the Division of Trading and Markets and the Division of Investment Management. Could you help us out with
that? Sure, be glad to do that. In fact, until 1995, when OC was created, the examination function was in trading and markets, or at that point known as market regulation, and the Division of Investment Management. The major difference between us is, as a field organization, we are out visiting the registered firms. We are going to their offices, we're looking at their books and records, we're interviewing their staff, and then we're making observations, or as we call them, findings, not the findings of the commission, but we typically call them findings, that we will then put into a report and put into a deficiency letter to the firm. So we're working directly with that firm. The Division of Trading and Markets and Investment Management they're more on the regulatory side. They're drafting rules, they're issuing opinions, interpretive guidance. They are more on the regulatory side while we're on the field side. But I can tell you we cooperate with them very carefully. We have a number of different things, programs in place to make sure that we're completely in sync as to what we're doing and what they would want us to do. They're involved in our planning memos as we decide what we're going to do. They're involved in our examination modules as to how we'll look at particular issues. When we have a new initiative, they will review the plans that we have for those initiatives. And actually, because of electronic records, they have a level of review today that I don't think anyone had in the past, because we can actually give them access to our electronic exam reports. So people in trading and markets and investment management today can use Boolean logic searches to see exactly what the exam program is doing and has been doing. So oddly enough, I think we're very tightly coordinated. We work together very well. But the dividing line is we're out in the field and they're giving regulatory, running regulatory programs in headquarters.
I think it might or might not be helpful if you could tell us just a bit about what the difference is between a division and an office, and does that have anything to do with your relationship with the Division of Trading and Markets and the Division of Investment Management?
Well, I think the short answer to the last question is no. And the difference between an office and a division, I think, has no operational significance at all. Or at least if it does, in all the years I've been with the agency, I've never noticed it. As a technical matter, I believe generally the divisions are seen to be more covering a number of different areas, and the offices tend to be focused in on a particular issue. For example, the Office of General Counsel. Very important office, does a lot of different things, but because they're the in-house lawyers for the commission, they're an office rather than a division, as I understand it. And it's the same thing for OSCE, that because we're focused on examinations, we're an office. But you know, I have to admit, if you were to go around and take a poll of SEC staff, you'd probably get different answers from all of them. I'm not really sure what the difference is. Someone somewhere may know exactly what the difference is, but I do not.
I'd always wondered and had not remembered to ask until just now.
Well, when we first started back in the mid-90s, I asked the same question about what's the difference between an examination and an inspection. And
I
did legal
question.
Research, and I talked with people, and ultimately, at the end of the day, I realize there really is no difference. They're all examinations, but over time, simply as a matter of usage, some of them are now called inspections. But technically, if you look at the statutes, they're all actually examinations.
Uh-huh. You know, I had sort of fancied that perhaps examinations were what happened when people brought information to you, and inspections were what happened when you went to them. But
I like that. That's actually a good explanation, but that's
but
not.
No.
No, very creative, but no, unfortunately, that's not it.
You've mentioned that OSCE was founded in the 1990s. Could you tell us a little bit about the motives for splitting it out then?
Sure. This was when Chairman Lovett was chairman of the commission. And the agency encountered some difficult issues relating to market makers. And these were the issues that resulted in the 21A report that the commission issued. And Chairman Lovett decided that he wanted the examination program to have more management focus, more people focusing exclusively on exams for their own sake, and thinking, what can we do to make sure that exams are functioning well and performing as they should. He also wanted an examination program that, as I recall his words, quote, didn't pull any punches, don't pull any punches. And I think these two goals, management focus and being hard-hitting, not pulling any punches, are really what has animated the examination program ever since. Now, in terms of taking these strategic goals and playing them out into how we actually run the office, I think there are a couple different things. One is programmatic effectiveness. Examinations are different. They're not investigations. They're not regulatory work of issuing a no-action letter or something like that. They occupy their own space. And so having an office that was concerned just with that made a lot of sense, just as having an office just concerned with enforcement investigations made a lot of sense. And we've put a lot of time and effort over the years into doing that, training, planning, getting examiners together to talk about shared experiences and so on. Another goal is managerial efficiency. Between 20 and 25% of the agency is in the examination program, and it made sense to pull that all together into one place so it could be managed effectively. And we've opened up some new program areas like risk assessment, technology, and so on, that is more efficient and works across the entire program because we have that economy of scale. I think one of the key visions that Chairman Leavitt had and that we continue to work toward is that the securities industry is growing together. The old days when a broker was in a box over here and did just broker things and an advisor was in an advisor box over there and did just advisor things, those days are gone. And to really understand the industry, we need to look across all of these different types of registrants, and that's something else we've been doing. And finally, I think to make sure that people understand what we do, to have more outreach to the industry and to be more transparent so people understand who we are. Most of our work is non-public. Examinations are non-public. So in the absence of affirmative outreach, the only contact you would have with the program is what we do when we come in to see you, and we're trying to broaden that more so people understand better what we're up to. But the bottom line, I think, that the Chairman Leavitt really animated this decision was the management focus and the don't pull any punches.
As a relative new baby for the commission, was OC tenderly nurtured and given lots of resources to do the things that it was expected to do?
Well, I think actually the most important thing it's gotten, and I think it's gotten this consistently through the years, it's gotten the support of the chairman, it's gotten the support of the commissioners. The reality is, and we recognize this, nobody likes to be examined. Sometimes registrants are very nice, and at the end of an examination they'll say, thank you very much, we appreciate your comments. But the reality is nobody really likes somebody coming and digging around through their firm looking for risks or looking for problems. And I'm aware of chairmen and commissioners who have said, you know, if we didn't get complaints from time to time about all these pesky questions, we would wonder whether you were doing your job. But at the end of the day, they've given us that support, and I think that's really the important issue. They said, look, we understand what you're doing, we understand why you're doing it, and we support it. Each of the chairmen, too, has added to what we're doing. And I think that's over the history of the office. It's been interesting to see how each new chairman has added something. For example, Chairman Leavitt was really focused on looking for compliance violations, making sure we were really hard-hitting and looking for those issues. Chairman Pitt talked about real-time enforcement, real-time regulation. We changed the program in a number of ways, such as always having exit interviews to get the information back to the registrant immediately so they could immediately begin to act on it. When he was chairman, Chairman Donaldson focused on risk, and we began the whole process of revamping our program to look at risk and to consider risk in what we did. And then finally, Chairman Cox has really emphasized the outreach program, outreach to CCOs, outreach to the compliance community. So in their own ways, each of the chairmen, I think, has given us tremendous support and had a key role in shaping the program and directing it and making what it is today.
Would you say that, and you may have answered this already, but just to be perfectly clear on it, would you say that there was much industry resistance either to its formation or to the expansion of its mandate?
Well, I would say that it all depends what you're asking, because I think one of the most important successes of OC over the years has been its relationship with the compliance community. And I think standing now in 2008 and looking back at what's happened with the compliance community over the last few years, I think it's made dramatic changes, improvement, evolution. And I think our relationship with the compliance community has always been very good, very positive. I think like any good, positive relationship, you know, it has its up moments, it has its down moments. But nonetheless, it's been very, very good and very affirmative for both of us, both for us as regulators and for them as compliance personnel. I think there have been other portions of the regulated community that perhaps have not felt quite so positively about OC, depending on the situation. And as I said, no one likes to have someone come in and look over your shoulder and say, here's what you're doing wrong. So we would expect to hear some of that.
Now, I think you indicated that OC accounted for roughly 20 to 28%. Is that right? Or what?
Somewhere between a fifth and a quarter. Right now we have total OC in headquarters and then examiners in the regional offices 800-plus total. And I believe it's somewhere between 820 and 840 right now. But as you know, in the federal government, it all depends whether it's full-time equivalents or headcounts. But if you think 800-plus, that's a good round number.
And generally, you describe the organization in terms of there being a home office and being and field examiners?
That's correct. Actually, as a technical matter, OC is only in headquarters. And then the examiners in the regional offices, they're within the regional office structure. And OC has program management over them, just as the Division of Enforcement has program management over them. I think probably one of the more important organizational changes that's taken place since OC was created, in addition to the enhancement to the risk assessment and the new technology office and issues like that, is the fact that today the programs in the regional offices report both to enforcement and to OC, depending on which program. For a period of time, the programs reported as line managers up to enforcement, and now it's more the regional office being a direct report to the chairman and the programs reporting separately to the program offices.
Does that mean that the same personnel might be engaging both in inspection activity and enforcement activity? Or
it could. It could. And, in fact, it's not uncommon. It's not doesn't happen every day. But it's not uncommon that examiners will, during an examination, find an important issue. They'll find something that they think warrants enforcement scrutiny. They'll refer it to enforcement, and the enforcement staff in their office will say, well, you know, you've been spending a lot of time looking at this. We're going to put you on the formal order so you can help us with this investigation, and that does happen. And I think that's a way that we support enforcement. I always like to say enforcement is our second most important customer behind the commission itself. And so we provide a lot of assistance to enforcement along those lines.
That's very interesting. My next question was going to be whether you had any thoughts you'd be willing to share about the interactions of OC with the divisions and other offices, and you've started down the road. Can you tell us more?
Sure. I actually think that we are both a customer of other offices. For example, the OIEA, the Office of Investor Education and Advocacy, they receive complaints from investors and others. And then that is critically important to us because they will then share them with us, and we can use them to target examinations, to do cause reviews, to when we're doing our homework before we go into the field to get a sense on how a firm is doing, judging by the complaint traffic that it receives. And I think we have a great relationship with them. On the other hand, looking from us as almost in a vendor relationship to somebody else being our customer, I think that's true with both the regulatory offices and with enforcement, where we will do sweep reviews at the request of one of the regulatory offices, where someone, say, an associate director will say, you know, we're thinking about this rulemaking. Could you go out and take a look at this area for us and see what's actually happening today? And we can go out and do a coordinated review, do a report, give it to them, and then they can say, well, you know, this is great. We can think about this in terms of the recommendation we make to the commission in regards to whether we need a new rule or not, something like that. And with enforcement, in a relatively small percentage of our examinations, and it only ranges from about 5% to about 15%, more or less, depending on the type of firm, we'll hand it over to the Division of Enforcement for further investigation. Relatively small percentage, but nonetheless, that oftentimes is the most serious. Those are the most serious issues that we find, so very important relationship there. I think our relations with the other offices are very good. I think we work very hard on both sides, both our side and the other offices' side, to make it a success, and I think it has been.
What sort of relationship, as long as we're on the topic of relationships, sort of a relationship does OC have with state regulators?
Again, I think very good. We've done a number of coordinated reviews with them. For example, the senior activity that's going on right now, looking at senior investors and the special compliance risks that they entail. I think we've done a lot of really good work with states in that area, and other areas as well. I think so. It's a good relationship. I think that again, we work really hard to make it a success, and the state regulators do as well. And they'll call on the phone and ask, hey, what are you doing in this area, and do you have any thoughts on this? And Also, they'll call on the phone and say, you know, hey, we have an issue here that seems to involve an SEC registrant you might be interested in, and we'll do the same. So it's a good relationship.
So you do cross-refer and share information?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. In fact, we have MOUs with many of the states to facilitate the sharing of information and to make it work very well. Absolutely.
And how about foreign regulators?
Well, that really depends on the foreign regulator. I think that's an evolving issue, that with some regulators, it's great. We have, in some cases, we have formal MOUs with them. We'll do joint exams. We'll regularly share information. With others, it's developing. But I think the trend has been very positive across the board. I think probably with all foreign regulators, the trend is toward more sharing and better coordination. I can't, as I sit here right now, think of anywhere the trend is moving in the other direction.
It sounds like you're generally describing a picture of a lot of progress and enthusiasm for the enterprise.
I have to tell you, I really am enthusiastic. I think one of the things that I enjoy most, you know, going into the office in the morning, is I think there really is a lot of enthusiasm. I think people really, there's a clear sense of mission. We know what we do. We know how we do it. And I think people are really enthusiastic about that. And maybe some of that's coming across here.
And deservedly. Well, can you translate some of that into specifics of some of the what you consider the OC's most important initiatives to have been? You've mentioned a couple of things, but I'm interested in more detail about the kinds of things it's done in the last 13 years. And
sure. Well, I would actually divide that into two categories. I think there's some things that I would call the tangible successes, things where you can actually point to a specific thing and say, here was a success. I think, for example, right out of the box after we were created, we did sales practice reviews that I think were very successful. Some people called them the rogue broker reviews. We also put out a few years ago a report on soft dollar practices that I think was very helpful. We did a number of reviews relating to payments for shelf space that looked at both the fund side that was making the payment and the broker side that was receiving the payment. I think the variable annuity sales report we did with the NASD a few years ago was very important. New York Stock Exchange specialists, again, very critical findings in a critical area. And CCO outreach, which is an initiative we're doing right now, and it's very important and I think has really helped our relations with compliance professionals. The intangible successes, it's a little harder to sort of pin down to a particular thing. But I think one of the things that I'm proud of is, heck, we've kept up, I think, with the industry. And if you look over the last 13 years...
No mean feat.
Oh, it's grown a lot. It's become more complex. There's a lot going on. And if you look at where we are now and where we were back in 1995, just keeping up, I think, is quite a victory. I think a second thing is we've really developed an internal infrastructure that allows us to share internally, that allows us to stay in touch with each other, to track examinations, to set up a system where any examiner for the SEC anywhere in the country can see everybody else's work product, can actually read the reports written by another office, use Boolean logic to search those reports to find things of interest to them. And we're working on an initiative that someday soon we hope they'll not only be able to read each other's reports but look at each other's work papers as well in the same way. And I think that's an important step forward in enhancing the overall success of the program. But personally, the thing I think I would point to as a success is our ongoing relationship with the compliance community. I think we have developed a tremendous relationship with compliance professionals and regulators. It's really changing the nature of the relationship between regulator and regulatee. And I think it's an intangible achievement, but I think a very important one.
Is there a dark side of the moon as well?
I guess there always is, isn't there? I assume you'd like to hear what I think our failures are. Well, it pains me to say it, but it's true. We missed illegal market timing. And, I could sit here and tell you all the reasons why we missed it. There's a lot of legal market timing and on, but the fact of the matter is we missed it. And that became, as you know, a very big deal when it was discovered, mm-hmm. And I certainly wish we had found it. But I think when you look at what happened after illegal market timing was discovered, I think that actually says a lot about the program that we have and what we've tried to do. One of our key goals with this management focus is this whole idea of continuous improvement, to make sure that we always learn from our mistakes. We're continuously working to make the program better. And when market timing came to light, we sat down and said, how did this happen? And how do we make sure it doesn't happen again? We dramatically enhanced our risk assessment tools. We started reviewing emails much more carefully. We realized that email reviews were a critical part of our oversight. And we actually changed the program a lot. So, yeah, it was the dark side. There were a lot of dark days there, no question about it. But I think we've learned from it, and the program is a much better program because of it. Not that I'm inviting anything like that again, you understand.
Well, I would fancy that the workload of OC would be pretty substantial. You've talked a little bit about the number of feet on the ground you have mm-hmm. to deal with it, but what kind of a workload are we talking about?
Generally, we do more than 2,500 examinations in a year. And some years it's higher than that, but I would say 2,500 again is a good round number to sort of that will give you a sense on what our workload is.
And how many entities / individuals / whatever SROs are out there to be dealt with?
Well, let me see now. I must warn you, whenever I start stringing numbers off the top of my head, there's a high probability of error. So I want to put an asterisk. I'm going to put an asterisk next to it here. About 11,000 advisors. Past the 10,000 mark, and I'm pretty sure it's now up to about 11,000. About 5,000 broker-dealers who do business with the public. There's some others who are on floors, but the 5,000 number I think is probably pretty good. Let's see, I believe we have about 400 transfer agents. I would guess around, how many SROs? Well, let's quit there. Oh, investment company complexes, I think we're down to about 900, something like that.
Still an eye-popping number.
Yes. Well, overall, the numbers are pretty big. When you get to the exchanges and the SROs, the number is smaller. And I could probably count them right here, but it's in the tens rather than mm-hmm. in the thousands, obviously.
Right. And obviously when you're talking about...
Oh, and don't forget clearing agencies, the PCAOB, rating agencies, which are brand new for us, but others as well.
Yeah. So there is a huge amount of work to be done, in short.
There is. There is. And this is where I think the risk assessment is so important, because until just a few years ago, we had an approach that said, we're going to try and get out to everybody within a particular community within a certain periodicity or within a certain number of years. And I have no objection to that. I think it was a good way to do it, given what we had at the time. But I think that one of the advantages we have now with the infrastructure we've been able to develop, which is far more sophisticated in terms of its risk assessment, where we can actually take a look at firms and say, well, how risky are they really? Or take a look at activities and say, how risky are they? And then target what we're doing much more carefully. And I think that's really probably one of the most important changes between 1995 and now. Is what the firms never see. It's all back in OC, but that sort of algorithmic number crunching, looking at risks, sorting them, ranking them, and saying, yes, at the end of the day, let's go look at that firm for that purpose.
Do the firms know why they're being inspected at any particular time?
As a general matter, we don't say to the firm when we show up, we don't give them a particular reason. We don't say, you know, we're here because you were scored high risk or something like that. But I think the reality is a compliance professional who knows what they're doing, they'll figure it out pretty quickly. There's no question.
I read in a document that was produced in 1995, shortly after the office was formed, that the inspection cycle for investment advisors was then once every 20 years. And the report seemed to be complimentary in that that was down from every 22 years.
Well, it was pretty amazing. There's no question that in fact, I think that there were different categories, of course, that there were the advisors that had custody mm-hmm. and those that did not. But one of the things that makes our current approach so exciting for everyone, us included, is it's now impossible really to say how often we're going to come and see somebody, because with the risk-based approach, we really don't do it that way. And let me tell you some of the ways we do it. For example, with investment advisors in particular, because you raised them, there is a risk scoring process where there is a special group in the investment advisor, investment company office that will score the risks that they see in the registration materials of investment advisors, do a distribution, and then take the top, at least riskier, appearing advisors, and we'll make sure we get out to see them at least once every 3 years. Now, we can trump that by what we see on the ground if we go in and we say, you know, we thought this firm was high risk. It's not high risk. And they can then move to the low risk category. Or we can go to a low risk advisor and say, whatever the algorithm says, this should be high risk. We can do it that way, too. We look at higher risk activities. We have a whole risk management process. We have some full-time risk managers. They have a thing called RADAR. Which is the risk assessment tool that every examiner puts in their risks. They score them, you know, how likely is it that it will happen? How bad is it if it happens? What can we do about it? And at the end of that process, we say, well, you know, we should go look at this risk here and that risk there. So we may be picking them for that reason. We do statistical reviews. And this is where it becomes totally impossible to say why we're going to a firm, because we may not even know. Our friends in the Office of Economic Analysis we'll do a random selection process of low-risk advisors, create a sample of low-risk advisors who have been selected that way, and then we go and do reviews of them. And that actually does a number of things. It tests and validates the risk assessment process. We think they're low-risk. Are they really low-risk? And I'm glad to say that those reviews have generally have substantiated the low-risk advisors that we've picked are low-risk. Helps show the flag in areas where we might not otherwise have the opportunity to go and visit. And it helps us look for things we don't expect. How do you look for the unexpected? Well, one way is just to look and see what you see, and that does it. And then finally, there are cause exams, and that's a very traditional kind of exam where there's a particular issue, a complaint or a newspaper article or something, and we go and look. So if you're at the firm and you're wondering, why are these people here? And you could say, well, is it am I high risk? Maybe. Is it a risk activity? Maybe. Is it purely random? Maybe. Is it a cause? Maybe. So that for the firms, though, I think the way they figure it out is what we're asking for. And if we come in and we want to know all about the personal trading of portfolio manager X, and that's all we're asking for, I think they can figure out pretty quickly that's a cause exam. There's something wrong. There's something going on with Mr. X that they're interested in. If we come in and we're doing a broad-based review and we're asking about a lot of different issues and things like that, well, then I'm sure a qualified compliance person would say, well, it sounds to me like this is a regular review. A very long answer, and I know in the old days you could say 5 years or 20 years, and instead I had to say all of that, but that'll give you a sense of really where we're trying to head. We're trying to be much more sophisticated, that we're not simply saying, okay, we've been here, we'll see you in 20 years. We're trying to say, well, where are the risks and how do we find them and how do we uncover them?
Now, you may have suggested in that answer that there are sometimes mutating hot spots that a particular kind of practice will come to earth and may turn out to be more widespread in one of the regulated in one type of regulated player rather than another. Is that accurate?
I think that's right. I mean, just to give you an example, valuation, I think, over the last year or so, valuation has been a hot spot across the program. Broker-dealers, investment advisors, you know, funds, I think valuation has become a hot spot, and we've been putting resources into it, again, across the program. So that happens. Now, but we also try to make sure that no one is forgotten, you know, that no one's sort of neglected and ignored. So we care very much whether it's a transfer agent, a broker-dealer, an investment advisor, and make sure that all of that is included in the planning process and what we're going to go and do for a particular year. So I think, on the one hand, it seeks to make sure that we're taking a holistic view across all of the entities and that they're getting the attention each of them require, but absolutely there are hot spots that come up that we want to focus on. One of the advantages of having the consolidated management, of course, is if there is a hot spot, we can say, well, how does this particular issue relate to this type of firm and that type of firm and think about it that way as well, instead of coming out in different places and in different areas.
You mentioned the possibility of complaints. Do you have any idea what the average number of complaints filed that would come to OC's attention during a year might be?
Well, I know that OIEA receives tens of thousands of complaints every year, and for some reason the number 70,000 pops into my head. That may have been a recent number. I mean, they handle tens of thousands every year. So for them, a major part of the process is getting the complaints sorted by classification and available for use by examiners. The complaints that come directly to us, some do simply because people know examiners. I actually get some myself. We have a hotline. And the SEC exam hotline is available to anybody who has a comment or a concern or a complaint about an examination. And we set it up because we think it's very important that anybody who's in the exam system can reach into the senior levels of OC and say, hey, I've got a question here, I've got a concern here. And we put it in our brochure. We hand out the brochure to every firm at the beginning of every exam. So every registrant that's being examined has that kind of access to OC's front office. But to classify what we get, it's all kinds of things. A lot of it, to be honest, most of them are what I would call facilitation calls. They have a question that has nothing to do with the exam hotline, but that's the number they have. So they call and they say, here's my question. And I say, well, that's not really a hotline question. And they said, yeah, but I see this number right here in the brochure. And I say, we'll figure out who you need to talk to.
If someone were to call that number, it wouldn't actually ring your desk, would
yes,
it?
Yes, it would. Actually, it would ring on my desk and the desks of a handful of attorneys, senior attorneys who sit around me. And every once in a while, I will get a call, and whoever's there will pick it up, and it's a special button and everything. And so we're all supposed to, whoever, you know, gets to the phone first, and sometimes I'll answer the phone, and it's somebody I'll know, and say, John, I was just curious. You really do answer this stuff, don't you?
I was going to go home and dial that
number. Yeah, exactly. Actually, most of the hotline-type things I hear, to be honest with you, either come on my personal line or people take me aside in person at a conference or something like that. And they say, you know, I was thinking of calling the hotline. I have a hotline type issue, and let me ask you before I call it. And I say, well, it doesn't matter, because if you call the hotline, you're going to get me anyway, so you might as well just tell me now.
You must have a great time at conferences.
Yeah. Well, it's very important. We take this outreach very, very seriously, and it really is a two-way street. It really is. It's very important for us both to talk with people about what we're saying and what our concerns are, but also for people to share with us what they're concerned about. And it can be very, very valuable, both in terms of finding out what risks are that we may not be thinking about or that we've thought about, but perhaps we need to ratchet it up and say, maybe this is more serious than we thought, or even just people expressing generalized concern, sort of what's the mood, the temperature.
I'd like to turn to a little more in-depth consideration of the inspection methods that you use. What can you tell us about what happens in an inspection? You said something about email, and I'll have more specific question about that perhaps. But actually, I'll go ahead and ask the specific question now, because this was one that was emailed to us from a listener, Daniel O'Connor of Ropes & Gray LLP, who emailed us to ask, what can you tell us about what registrants, that is, broker-dealers and investment advisors, should expect in terms of requests by the exam staff for email productions in routine exams? For instance, what number of people and what time periods might be covered?
Well, the email reviews are very important. I would just even broaden that and say communication reviews are very important in examinations, as they are in compliance and supervisory management of a firm. So what we're doing here, I think, is similar to what hopefully the supervisors and the compliance professionals at a firm are doing, and looking at these electronic communications and saying, well, how can we actually approach this in a way that makes sense to see what's happening in that firm or at that trading desk or whatever? We went through a period of time immediately after market timing broke where we used email reviews as what I would call sort of a reality check. During market timing, there were problems at firms and from people that were quite surprising. And we said, my gosh, you know, I can't, what is happening here? How did that happen? And so we did very large email reviews, and we made no secret of what we were doing. We told everyone. We said we're looking at this in an effort to understand what the real culture of compliance is at this firm. Not what you're telling us, not what you're telling the world, but what's really happening in the front office or elsewhere. And during those days, we would make requests for large numbers of emails to and from a large number of people over a large period of time. More recently, and I think, by the way, that was a valid sort of crises tool, a valid thing to do in that time period, but there's no question it was very difficult for the firms producing them. It was very difficult for us reviewing them. Now we're in a mode where we're trying to be much more targeted in what we do. We may come in and say, please give us the emails to and from the trading desk for this this particular period of time. Please give us the emails to and from the advertising department and those who review and approve the advertising for this particular period of time. So the gentleman who sent in the email request, I would say more likely than not, it will be a targeted review rather than an all-encompassing review. But we still, from time to time, will use those requests going to individuals for a period of time if we feel our pursuit of the evidence or our pursuit of what we need to finish our exam leads us to that point.
What other kinds of things would you do in a typical investigation of, pick your player, and a broker-dealer? What other things would you be looking at other than email?
Well, we'd give the firm a request list, and that would talk about the documents we wanted to see, and could be, client accounts. I think you mentioned broker-dealer. It could be account statements. It could be their compliance controls. Could be downloads of trading data. I think one of the things that has revolutionized what we do and has revolutionized what compliance people do is electronic records make it possible to download and conduct screening, conduct assessments, who's paying what commissions, where are the trades going. You can get a level of oversight that just a few years ago would have been impossible. One examiner, one compliance professional sitting in front of a laptop today that in the paper and pencil era would have required, warehouses full of people at desks, and they probably still could not have done as good a job. And that's a key part of our program. We will then interview people. We'll want to have a conversation with them and say, we've been looking at what is happening here at the trading desk or wherever. We'd like to talk with you about it and see, get your explanation. Or we see these recommendations you're making. We'd like to get your explanation for them. And then finally, when the review is over, we will typically give them what we call a deficiency letter. And that letter goes through the problems we found and asks them to fix them.
It does obviously sound as though the process has gotten much more automated, or makes much more use of electronics and, I assume, software.
We do have some pretty good analytical software now for trading and portfolios and for doing various email reviews and things like that. In fact, going back to managerial focus, one of the things we've done recently is creating a technology office within OC, which is led at the assistant director level and has a staff of very experienced and highly qualified technology experts who can help in these areas, and both in terms of electronic record productions and things like that, but also in pushing forward our initiatives to enhance our ability to use technology. So we actually are pushing that along.
I was imagining people reading all the emails and then making the next leap to the software that some people put on their home computers to monitor what their children are doing, that screens for particular words or word patterns. Do you have anything that involved?
Good compliance shop should be doing that. And that started a few years ago, very basic searches for words. I think now they've gotten much more sophisticated than that in terms of word searches and patterns and issues like that. But that's an important part, I think, of any kind of compliance process.
You mentioned that the end result of an inspection might very well be a deficiency letter.
Yes.
What percentage of inspections turn up the sort of problem that would be commemorated in a deficiency letter?
Well, it varies from year to year and from type of firm to type of firm, but I would say typically anywhere from, say, 60 to 80 or maybe even 90% in a given year. There are actually three possible outcomes. One would be the deficiency letter, which is by far and away the most common. Another is a closeout letter, in which we give the firm a letter and basically say, we came, we saw, we have no comment, thank you very much. And then the third possible outcome is an enforcement referral. Now, a particular statistic that I think is very interesting to watch is we have what we call significant deficiencies. And the significant deficiencies are those that we believe are, you know, significant enough because it stopped an ongoing problem, it identified a new risk, it went to, say, the firm's capital position, and there are a number of those in the definition. And we track those from year to year, and we actually publish those. Those are part of our annual report. And usually anywhere from about 35 up to close to 50% of our exams, depending on the year and the program area, will generate significant deficiencies. And you can actually go to our annual report on the Commission's website and see a table that shows what we did last year and in the previous year. So I think that's a good level of public accountability, what we're finding, measuring not just the inputs but the outputs, significant findings, and tracking it from year to year.
If an individual or entity receives a deficiency letter, is there typically a time frame for cleaning up the act?
Well, we want a response generally pretty quickly, though, you know, that's something where if a firm says, look, can you give me a few more weeks or something like that, more often than not, the exam team can work something out with them. But we would expect them to move reasonably quickly to fix any problems that were identified, and we ask them in their response to tell us either that they have fixed them or what they're doing to fix them. The difficulty is, and the most dangerous situation, is when a firm promises that it will fix it and then it does not. And I think that's something that is very dangerous for a firm. And when we come in to do an exam, if we look at the old deficiency letter and we look at what they're doing and they have promised us they will fix it and they haven't, then we will take that very seriously. And the Commission has actually brought some enforcement cases recently where the Commission authorized an enforcement action against a firm and in the order said that the reason it, you know, pointed to the firm's failure to respond to prior deficiency letters as part of the Commission's reasoning in bringing that action.
What types of deficiencies are the most common? And here, rather than picking broker-dealers, I'll pick investment advisors. What?
Well, I would say just to give you a few examples, disclosure, what's in their form ADV, what are they telling customers about themselves, performance advertising, very, very important area. Directed to your prospective customers and also your own customers, that what kind of advisor you are, very common. Valuation. Valuation is an issue for advisors that underlies a lot of different things, ranging from the fees you collect to, you know, your clients' satisfaction with you and how you're doing or not doing, as the case may be. So I think those kinds of issues are very common.
Would you say that there is much possibility that anything much would be missed during the course of an inspection?
Well, this is where it's really important that we're very disciplined, and I really want to emphasize that I think part of being an examination program as opposed to just talking with people on the phone or just getting briefed by people is that we try and take a very disciplined approach to what we're doing. We will have a scope, and we'll say, this is what we're looking at. And, of course, if we decide not to look at an area, we can't say anything about that area. We would hope that the risk management process would be very rigorous in terms of why we're looking at those areas, that we think those are the highest risk areas. The other areas don't warrant that kind of review. But once we get into that particular area, what records did we look at? Why did we decide it's an issue? Why did we decide it's not an issue? Do we have documentation in our work papers substantiating every statement we make in our report or in our deficiency letter? So I think the bottom line is that if it's within the scope of the review, and we've chosen this as a high-risk area that warrants review, I would hope we're not going to miss a lot. I would hope that we're going to be able to pick out those areas that need follow-up. If we decided not to look there because we think that's a lower risk area, well, if we're not looking, we're not seeing, and there it falls back on the risk assessment, which I think, as I've said, is much more sophisticated today than it used to be.
You mentioned earlier that occasionally you might go out and conduct a sweep at the behest of one of the divisions, and presumably to collect a pool of information. What sorts of information do you feel is fair game in that circumstance?
Well,
whatever.
An exam is an exam. I mean, if we do sweeps because someone has identified a risk, and we will go to the commission and say we think we should do a sweep in this area. Here's a risk that we think is really serious. How do you feel about us pursuing this through a sweep process? We may get the request from another division, but once we go and do it, it's really important to note that an examination is a mandatory regulatory exercise. And so when we come in, we will make record requests that we believe are relevant to the inquiry that we have been directed to make. We try really hard to make sure that we only ask for the records we need. Sometimes it's really essential that we ask for a lot of records, and some of our requests, I think we have to admit, they can involve a lot of documentation. We've done some reviews looking, say, at institutional order flow, for example, and other areas that have involved huge volumes of trading data. But what we really try and make sure that we don't do is we don't duplicate requests. So sometimes we'll have to ask for a lot, which I think is what you're getting at, but the problem is if we ask for the same thing two or three times, and I think we've really done a good job in recent years of managing the program to make sure that that does not happen. If it does, call me on the hotline. If you're aware of it happening, I'd want to hear about it.
I suppose what I was getting at, too, was the idea that a risk might be identified that or someone might be interested in trying to figure out whether a particular risk should become the target of regulation, that is not, it's not illegal per se yet, or it's not a matter of having violated the law, but we're thinking about whether it would be a good thing about which to have a regulation. Can you collect information for that purpose?
For broker-dealers and investment advisors, we have authority to look at all of their records, and that's in the statute, that if it's a brokerage record, if it's an advisory record, we have authority to look at it. I think if it's a risk area and we are examining that risk area, someone has said, another division, a commissioner, whatever, has said, we feel that that's a risk area that we think your program should look into, we can do that. And the result of that review could very well be that it's a risk area, but as we look at the regulatory system right now, in fact, we're not clear as to whether it's a violation. Perhaps the regulatory office, perhaps the commission should consider that. And that's a valid outcome for a sweep type review or any type review to say we're bumping into an issue here, and commissioners, chairmen, and regulatory offices, we want to bring this to your attention.
As I've indicated before, I basically think that the workload of OC is extraordinarily great. Do you think that you really have enough funds to do what it is you need to do?
That's a tricky question. That's a tough one. We could always use more help, absolutely. But I think one of the things we have really tried to do, and I would emphasize this, is to take the tools we're given and to make them work as best we can. And I think we've really done that. But if you have more staff, you want to offer them to me, I won't turn them down.
Are you expecting any changes in funding or mandate in the foreseeable future?
Certainly, I think in mandate, I'm not expecting anything. I think there have been a number of new rules that the commission has adopted. As soon as they adopt a rule, of course, we immediately try and work it into our program. But for funding, I'll have to defer on that. If you're offering it, I'll take it. But again, I think we take a great deal of pride in saying, what are the tools we're given, and let's make it work, and I think we have.
You know, when you talk about new things that you've been given, you have just been given the rating agencies, and that puts me in mind, too, of the SROs. What kinds of things would you look for in an inspection of an SRO or an inspection of a rating agency?
Well, let's put rating agencies to the side. Actually, if you go to the Commission's website, you can see a recent report that was issued relating to rating agencies, and I think that would perhaps answer that question. But looking at SROs, we typically look at them from a programmatic perspective. We want to take a look at, say, surveillance or FinOp or the actual programs they're running, and then we inspect them on that basis. So it's sort of a top-down type approach. What is the SRO itself doing to regulate its members to run, in the cases where they actually have a trading facility, to actually run their trading market? We also have a bottoms-up approach, which is we will do a thing called an oversight examination, and there we go to a broker-dealer that has been recently examined by the SRO and do our own independent review of that broker-dealer, which shows us how the SRO is interacting with its members.
Makes sense.
We will both do a forensic review of the SRO's review and our own independent review to come to our own conclusion. So it's sort of top-down with programs and then bottoms-up with oversight exams.
We don't have a lot of time left, but I wanted to make sure that I got to this question, which has to do with the people of mm-hmm. OC. Aren't there any folks in OC's history, short as it relatively is, that you particularly would like to single out as memorable or as having made special contributions?
You know, I would, actually. I think, first of all, of course, is my boss, Lori Richards, who's been our director since it was created. And I think Lori has made a tremendous impact on the program, has really shaped it in many ways. And a lot of the things we've talked about here today, the risk assessment, the trying to look across the entire securities industry and not getting blocked into like little boxes here and there, but saying how do these different pieces all relate, I think a lot of that has been driven by Lori, and Lori has really made it happen. Another person that I'd like to mention is Carrie Dwyer. Carrie Dwyer was Chairman Levitt's counsel at the time OC was created, and Carrie really played a tremendous role working with Chairman Levitt and saying we needed an OC, we needed an office that does what OC does, and I don't really think her contribution to OC has been recognized as much as it should. I'd also actually like to note Gene Gulke. I don't know if you know Gene Gulke. Gene is an institution. He's been examining funds and advisors for a long time. He is just a tremendous resource to the program, and I think he should be noted. I should note, as a group, the line staff, we are incredibly lucky. We have a lot of really fine people who do examinations, very qualified, very skilled. And then finally, if I were to mention a last category that might seem a little unusual, our critics. We have been very lucky that over the years, a number of people have been willing to share their ideas with us, to step forward and say, here's what you're doing, here's what we think you could do better. And a lot of that feedback has really helped to improve the program, and we've taken it very seriously, and we've worked with it very carefully. So not that I'm inviting more criticism.
Here's that hotline.
Yes, call the hotline. But no, it's been very helpful, and I think that we really do appreciate the feedback we've gotten. That people care enough, they're willing to do it.
Very gracious response. John, thank you for sharing your invaluable insights into the work of OC. Thank you, too, for being part of the museum's history today, because we have just concluded the 50th online program in the Virtual Museum and Archive. All of these programs, including today's, can be accessed at any time in the online programs section of the museum in MP3, audio, and transcript format. I'd like to thank Pfizer, Inc., for its generous sponsorship of the Fireside Chats from 2005 throughout this season. Our 2008 online program season is now concluded, but I will be back on www.sechistorical.org on Tuesday, February 24th, for a Fireside Chat on the work of the SEC Division of Corporation Finance. I'll also be moderating Fireside Chats on the SEC Office of the Chief Accountant on April 21st, and the SEC Office of the Chairman on May 12th. And I'll be hosting the museum's first live broadcast from London when I moderate an online program on international securities regulation on March 12th. I'll look forward to joining you again in 2009. Thank you for being with us today.